don't, and it'll be up, please, you're certainly welcome to talk about the arguments going on, but talk to yourself, please, which will be out in this one.
Please be seated. The court is now ready to hear argument in 070541 TXI Transportation Company versus Randy Hughes.
May it please the court, Mr. Reagan Simpson will argue for the petitioner. He is reserving 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Mr. Simpson, I want to talk about voir dire. And in this case, it appears that there was one Hispanic on the voir dire panel and one person that looks Hispanic.
That's correct. Patricia White looked Hispanic, according to the jury consultant for the plaintiff.
Okay, just for the record, I am Hispanic. And I hope I look Hispanic. Now, there is what appears to be in a record race-neutral reasons for striking Gonzalez, and that being that he was a new resident of Wise County and that he worked for a, or his wife worked for a big corporation. On his face, it appears that the Batson challenge would fail. I want your response to that, and I also want to know what your thoughts are about this not being another reason to just eliminate peremptory strikes in the voir dire process.
The second question first. I think the second question is probably more of a rulemaking or perhaps a legislative decision on whether peremptory strikes are worth the effort. And Justice Brister, of course, has discussed that very recently in the Davis versus Fifth Electric Company case. Addressing your first question, everything in this case has to be looked at. All the issues are all intertwined. And what is different about this case from a lot of others, and what is similar about this case with the Davis versus Fisk case, is that you have front and center the racial issue. Before trial and before voir dire, there was discussion of the illegal alien evidence before the judge. And the judge, while he said, approach the bench if you're going to say certain things, he'd already decided to let in a statement made to an INS official in 1999. So the issue of illegal alien status was already before the court. The court knew that was a big issue. You have this note that says, looks Hispanic. And also, in the Davis versus Fisk case, racial discrimination was, in fact, the cause of action brought. Here you have what we think is a gratuitous injection of illegal alien evidence in the case, and that makes it all the more something that the court needed to look at and make a decision on. And when you have the note...
Does strike survive Davis versus Fisk?
I don't believe that it does.
Nobody asked him a single question?
Nobody asked him a single question. The only Hispanic was taken off the panel because the issues in the case, the way it was ended up trying, was certainly put that issue front and center. And you look at the totality of the circumstances, as I read the court's opinion, and that's one of the many issues that revolve around this.
I'm not familiar with Wise County. Is this a large Hispanic population? What are the demographics?
I'm not sure. It changed a lot since I grew up in Jack County, and it's a lot bigger, and it's kind of a bedroom community now of the Fort Worth area. So it's a much changed area.
There's not many on this particular jury thing.
There was only one, Frank Gonzalez, the only Hispanic. I think it's clear in the record. The issues in this case, I think, can be summarized in two sentences, the primary issues. First is this. The illegal alien evidence that was admitted, combined with the broad form negligent submission against both the truck driver and TXI, gave permission to this non-Hispanic jury to decide that the truck driver was responsible not because he crossed the center line of the highway, but because he crossed the U.S.-Mexico border and was allowed to drive the truck. The second point is, if you're going to put an 18-wheeler driving on the wrong side of the road, and all the surrounding motorists never see it on the wrong side of the road, and the accident happens in the 18-wheeler's own lane of traffic, you need a lot more evidence than what the plaintiffs came up in this case to make a plausible theory of fake left syndrome than they presented at the trial court.
There's a dispute.
And let all the defense evidence in.
There's a dispute with the experts on where the accident occurred.
I'm sorry?
There's a dispute with the experts on where that accident occurred, correct?
There is difference of opinions by the experts on the act where the accident occurred. That's correct.
Okay. Before we get into questions of whether or not the DPS officer's opinion should have been admitted, isn't it important for the other side to show that on a negligent hiring situation that your client had a duty to make sure that this driver was able to operate a vehicle, that type of vehicle especially, before he was hired, and do the list of factors that are outlined in their brief? So why isn't his legal status in this country an issue?
There are two reasons. Fundamentally, this is not a negligent hiring case. And the reason it isn't, you look at the Texas American Bank versus Bogus case, which cites the Mooney case, a Sixth Circuit case, and says, you know, if you have driver inattention or inattention by a worker, that's not a negligent hiring kind of situation because anybody can be inattentive. The reason fundamentally this isn't a negligent hiring case is because this is a case about whether somebody drove on the wrong side of the road. Everybody knows to drive on the right side of the road. Somebody who is issued a commercial driver's license by the state of Texas, who's passed a skills test, who's passed a knowledge test twice to get his license first and to get reinstated, knows to drive on the correct side of the road. How many years of training do you need to have in order to know to drive on the right side of the road? How much experience do you have to have? 3 years is, according to the majority opinion below, 3 years experience is certainly enough to know to drive on the right side of the road. So fundamentally, this is not a negligent hiring case. That claim was brought and not submitted in order to inject the illegal alien status into the case.
You're saying that every case that involves a car on the wrong side of the highway can never be a negligent hiring case?
I'm not saying every case, but I'm certainly saying this case, because the theory is that he drifted into the wrong lane. People know to drive on the right side of the road. This is not, he needed to know how to downshift his gears, or he needed to know about air brakes, or he needed to know something of that. This is not that kind of case. And
well, but I can see a case where the plaintiff could set up a situation where a driver has consistently been shown to be inattentive, playing his iPod or being on the cell phone or one thing like that or another, and end up on the wrong side of the of the highway stripe.
That's true, but those would be other things that would cause him to go on the wrong side of the highway: inattention, falling asleep, and of course, in this case, we have absolutely no record of any kind of problems that this driver had. The other reason it's not a negligent hiring case is evidence specific in this case, and that is the fact that he didn't have a Social Security number, the fact that he lied about getting his driver's license. Those issues have nothing whatsoever to do with his ability to drive a truck, and even the majority opinion below said that those are collateral matters. They have nothing to do with his driving ability. And that was the whole focus of this case, was he was an illegal alien. He didn't have a Social Security number. He was not here because he wanted to work but didn't have the right to be here. Ad nauseum questions about this pervades the entire trial on a negligent hiring claim that they ended up not submitting because they submitted a general negligence question which omitted the issue of driver incompetence.
You objected to the court's charge, correct?
Yes.
And what were those objections, and how should the case have been submitted?
The case, well, first of all, I don't think there should have been a negligent hiring claim submitted at all. And that was one of the objections that was made. But if it's going to be submitted, then we tendered, and it's behind the tab 11, I believe, of the court's the brief we supplied, page 51. Of the record, we submitted a proper question that would have, do you find the drivers unfit or incompetent? And that should have been submitted as part of a negligent hiring claim. Mr. Taylor said, we're not all that desirous of having that submitted. He did that to try to avoid any claim that he was inviting error by suggesting this question. And this court dealt with this in the Ulico casualty versus Allied Pilots case, where you said, if you submit something to try to make sure something's right, you're not inviting error. Well, now they're trying to claim, the Court of Appeals is trying to claim, that Mr. Taylor, by saying I'm not desirous of having this, he really didn't request it. It was requested, it was refused. On page 71, there was an objection generally to omission from the charge of a question inquiring about whether the driver was incompetent. And the reason that question wasn't submitted, the reason they never submitted a negligence per se question, which we also made an objection to at page 51 of the same record, is so that they could put everything in and argue generally and let the jury decide generally on the negligence question. And that's particularly acute when you look at, compare that with the negligent entrustment case against Mr. Belendez, which did require driver incompetence as part of it. So the jury looks at it and says, well, driver incompetence is required over here, but now on TXI and the truck driver, we just have this general negligence question with no guidance whatsoever. So I guess it could be any reason that they're negligent. He shouldn't have been behind that wheel because he didn't have a Social Security number. He shouldn't have been here in this country. He shouldn't have been driving. And if he hadn't been driving, this accident wouldn't have happened. And that has nothing to do with negligent hiring. This court has held that you have to have a nexus between the incompetence, alleged incompetence, and what happened on the road. There's absolutely no nexus whatsoever here in this case.
Let's talk about some of these decisions made on experts. And Justice Gardner's dissent states that the expert, Dr. Marshak, disregarded the observations of four disinterested witnesses and came to the conclusion that the accident occurred perhaps on the other side of the road based on some gouge mark in the road. And there's also a challenge as to whether or not that expert's opinion is even admissible because it failed certain standards. Can you address that, please?
Yes, I will. In fact, I have a handout that the court should have, which had experts from Dr. Marshak's opinion. And the two key things in his opinion are that the gouge mark made by the wheel of the Yukon defines the angle of the tractor trailer. Once the tire deflated, the wheel of the Yukon defines the angle of the tractor trailer. There's absolutely no scientific basis for saying that. And if you look on the excerpt that I provided, he says,
was there any scientific basis that the wheel deflated prior to the accident?
Well, we know that because of the collision, the wheel deflated. In fact, the entire wheel came off.
But that was the opinion of the DPS officer, right? That it's the, she hit something in the road causing the tire to deflate?
The DPS officer said, Officer Rainey said that that may have happened. But if you look at the first page of the handout, it says, is it your opinion there was no steering input provided at that point by the driver, Kimberly Hughes? I don't think there was much steering input. You don't know whether there was any steering input being provided by the driver of the Yukon. If you don't know what steering input is being provided by the driver of the Yukon, how can you tell that the direction of the wheel of the Yukon has anything to do whatsoever with the direction of the tractor trailer rig? Putting aside, if you look at Exhibit 272, which shows the entire left wheel is gone, putting aside that the change in the trajectory of the Yukon and the tearing off of the wheel could affect the direction of the gouge mark, there's absolutely no basis, scientific or otherwise, for saying that. The other key thing to all of his testimony is whether the is that his opinion that the tire made the gouge mark at the second wheel, when it hit the second wheel of the Yukon, and that's the second page I have in the handout, because he admits that there's more damage on the fourth wheel of the tractor trailer than there was at the second wheel of the tractor trailer. So how does he know that the tire made the gouge mark when it connected or collided with the second wheel as opposed to the fourth wheel, which seems to be kind of opposite of what you would expect? He has no basis for it other than, as Justice Gardner pointed out, it didn't fit his theory. So if it didn't fit his theory, it must have had the collision with the second wheel when it made the gouge mark rather than the fourth wheel. And then the last thing I have on the handout is his admission. Nobody knows what the braking was. Nobody knows what the steering was of the tractor trailer rig. It's all total speculation. That is Dr. Marshak's opinion.
Counsel, can I ask a question? You're running short on time, but also there seems to be a difference between your position about what these witnesses actually saw and opposing counsel's brief about what they did or did not see. Would you address that, please?
A lot of the issues in this case are common sense. When you're driving down the highway, are you looking at every car in front of you? No, you're not. But when those brake lights come on, or when somebody does something unusual, then you'll look at that car. That's what all these people said. I never saw the tractor trailer rig in the opposite lane of traffic. Jerry Don Lawrence said, it doesn't take a rocket science to know that the trailer wasn't outside of its lane. Michelle Winton says, I could see clearly in front of me. She was about to pass Jerry Don. I could see clearly in front of me. I think I would have seen the tractor trailer rig if it had gone into the to the other lane. Now they say, well, she didn't see the tractor trailer rig. Well, why didn't she see it? Because it was in his lane in front of Jerry Don Lawrence. So to say that she didn't watch it every time, she didn't have binoculars watching every movement of that tractor trailer rig, means nothing. We have motorists behind and in front of this tractor trailer rig that never saw it outside its lane. We have an accident that happened in the truck's own lane. It's nothing but total speculation that this fake less syndrome happened. And by putting this illegal alien evidence under the guise of impeachment, which it was not, under the guise of negligent hiring, which really wasn't submitted because the elements weren't submitted, and we objected to that, allow this jury to decide the issues of the case on things that juries should not decide issues on.
I want to ask a question on your rebuttal involving the charge and the submission for the twins that were lost in the accident and whether or not that submission in itself invited error.
Thank you, counsel. The court is now ready to hear argument from the respondents.
May it please the court. Mr. Brian Stagner will present argument for respondents.
May it please the court. Let me just start by getting immediately into, Justice Moody, I think your question on the relevance of the immigration evidence to the negligent hiring claim and the negligent entrustment.
And the first question was the striking of the only Hispanic juror in the Vannar panel and then the notation of the other person that looks Hispanic. And you know, that in itself and the reasons given in the record seem to be race neutral, but and you look into the totality of the entire case, it seems to be, good advocates set it up perfectly to exclude the Hispanics on the jury.
Yeah, I would. I would note one thing, that the looks Hispanic obviously wasn't next to Mr. Gonzalez. It was next to Patricia White.
Yeah, but it's not race neutral either.
Well, but we didn't strike Patricia White.
And I know. It shows us that somebody was thinking about that, doesn't it?
I'm sure it was written the same handwriting, I think we went through this in the brief, the same handwriting from the same jury consultant who noted other features, identifying features about the panel members.
Jury consultants not supposed to notice that feature, are they?
I don't know if they are or not. I would hope that that would not factor into what the...
To write down looks black?
No, I don't.
Dr. Batson?
No, I don't. What I know is that there were two race-neutral reasons given for striking Mr. Gonzalez. Patricia White.
And I won't bother you a long time about this. My colleagues don't all agree with. Why would we need to protect a system where we can strike the only Hispanic on the jury when the defendants are Hispanic, because we don't want people who have not been long-time residents of the county? Why is our fair and impartial system so dependent on, gosh, we need to have the right to keep those new residents from being on a jury?
And I'm not sure I can defend that, because I'm not sure I disagree with you on that fundamental issue. What I do know is that the existing case law allows that. It's one of the legitimate bases for striking jurors, for exercising peremptory strikes. I know that
peremptory survived Davis versus Fisk, since nobody asked the guy any questions about being a new resident.
I think it absolutely survives. It was the combination of being a new resident and working for a large transportation company. Not only that, but his wife worked in the transportation industry. And you can imagine, if you are suing a transportation company for...
Suing a trucking company, you just can't have anybody that works for airlines on the jury.
And the entire point of the peremptory system, whether we agree with it or not, is that you can strike the less than ideal juror as long as you do it on a legitimate basis. And both of those have been recognized in the law as legitimate grounds for doing that.
Fisk says we're going to be very, we're not going to believe that if you never asked him any question about it.
There's a completely different dynamic working in Davis versus Fisk, as I'm sure you know. It was a racial discrimination case where each side used all or virtually all of their peremptory strikes to get rid of the opposing race. It worked both ways. The plaintiff exercised 6 of 6 to get rid of white jurors, and the defense used 5 of 6 to get rid of the African-American jurors. And one critical difference there, too, I think, is that the race-neutral reasons that were offered for striking the African-American jurors, the panel members, were actually more true of the white panel members who were not struck. The perfect example was one of the explanations offered for striking an African-American juror is that by a nonverbal look, a smile or a smirk, they seemed to express a willingness to assess punitive damages. They were struck for that reason. Yet the white panel members, who openly acknowledged that they'd be happy to assess punitive damages, they were not struck. So it just didn't hold water in that case, and you had the other dynamic of it being a race relations case.
What's the legal nexus of the so-called illegal alien in the cause of this accident?
The way it's been painted, I think I'll say right here, I don't think there is a nexus between an illegal alien crossing the center line.
Why was it so significant in this case? So significant that the first witness called by your side was the defendant driver himself.
Sure, and let me start with the negligent entrustment. It's the easiest to explain. Negligent entrustment is the requirement that the driver be unlicensed or unfit. Doesn't have to be both. That's this court's holding in Williams v. Steves, where you had a qualified driver with a safe driving record, and what the court said there is it is adequate to be unlicensed. That's enough to sustain a claim for negligent hiring.
Yes, but the trial could have taken place with evidence that this driver was unlicensed. You didn't have to get into the illegal alien status to make that point.
I respectfully disagree on that. The statutory requirement to hold a commercial driver's license, both under Texas law and the Federal Motor Carrier Act, is have a Social Security number or be a legal non-resident.
Yes, but couldn't the parties have agreed, okay, there will be evidence here that this driver is unlicensed. We stipulate to that without reference to immigration status.
That's possible. In fact, Your Honor, if you look at our first question, it was, did you lie on your driver's license application? That was it. If he had said yes, we could have moved on. He didn't say yes. He said, no, I did not lie on my driver's license application. At that point, We have no choice but to show how he lied on that driver's license application.
Show a criminal conviction on that basis?
We did not show a criminal conviction on that basis, Your Honor. What we showed was, and now we're sort of jumping into the negligent hiring. So we had the negligent negligent entrustment based on the fact that he was unlicensed, and you get a negligent hiring. And our goal on negligent hiring was to show, one, that TXI had not done its due diligence, that his 7 years of hiring experience, which was the only basis for putting him behind the wheel of his truck. He had no training. He admitted he had no training. That was the one true thing he said on his application. TXI admitted it didn't train him. TXI admitted that it didn't test him. They took on face value the 7 years of uninterrupted driving experience in and around Dallas. And what we were able to prove, in part through this immigration evidence, through the INS Q&A, that he swore under oath that he was using a false Social Security number to work in the United States. He had not lived in the United States until 1996, which disproved the first job. His first driving job that he had listed on his application was from 94 to 96. We were able to use his sworn statement, prior inconsistent statement under oath, that he was not even in the United States until 96. We were also...
It's all a collateral matter, though. What?
It's not a collateral matter, Justice Heck. The only way that... If you look on the face of
the... He might have lied on his marriage license, but...
But his marriage license didn't qualify him to drive. Under the Federal Motor Carrier Act, you're qualified based on two things, training or experience.
Your whole case is he crossed over the yellow line rather than what all the eyewitnesses say, which is that your client crossed over the yellow line. And what is it about a commercial driver's license that only people that have that know you shouldn't cross over the yellow line? I mean, my 11-year-old daughter knows you don't cross over the yellow line. Why does proving that his license was no good show that, that's why he... I mean, there's got to be a causal connection, and I don't see why that proves he didn't know you weren't supposed to cross the yellow line.
Your Honor, both TXI's witness, Mr. Kinnemer, and our regulatory expert, Mr. Benzmiller, testified that the more experience a driver has, the less likely that driver is to cause an accident. We're not claiming that...
I disagree with that, but this accident didn't happen from backing up or parallel parking or something that's hard to do. This is just driving down the street. Do you go over the yellow line or not?
Sure. And that's...
You don't have to go to Harvard for that. You agree with that?
Absolutely. This isn't about... We've never contended that Mr. Rodriguez was a maniac driving down the road on the wrong side. He never would have gotten to paradise that day had he been driving down the wrong side of the road. We've never contended...
You don't have to do that, though. In today's politically charged world, with the so-called illegal immigrant being the burden of all of America's problems, just as our unfortunate society has blamed American Indian, the Italians at different period of time, the Irish, the Jews, now it's the illegal immigrants' turn again. And it seems in this context, when you read the entire record, that it was only offered to do just that, to let this jury know that we have an illegal alien over here who may have caused this horrible, horrendous accident, and we want you to punish him. Disregard the facts. So tell me how that is wrong, that my view of that is wrong.
Because it all goes to his experience. Again, TXI, throughout trial, said that this man had 7 years of uninterrupted driving experience without an accident. We were able to prove, in part using the immigration evidence, that he had a little over 2 years. And we were able to do that by directly showing that, for example, when he said that he had been here from 94 to 96 driving, we used the immigration evidence to show he was not here till 96. When he claimed he had worked for 19 straight months immediately before this job. So we're not. It wasn't a faded memory problem. When he said he had worked 19 months for aggregate haulers prior to this job, we were able to show that 3 months into that job, he had been deported.
Let's talk about the charge. There was a submission in the charges, if my memory is correct, about the two unborn twins. And there's no cause of action for that, no recovery for that. The judge corrected that after the verdict. But that in itself seems to invite error, that if for whatever reason the judge submits this, he should have known that he can't recover on that, but it just seems like it adds more. Got an illegal alien who killed, who was involved in an accident, very horrible. You have these two unborn twins. And so that submission was wrong in itself. Why isn't that reversible error?
Your Honor, as we point out in the brief, the jury was going to know that Afton was pregnant. It was in the medical records. That was all admitted without objection as part of her survivor claim. So the jury was going to know that she was pregnant,
absolutely,
whether we asserted a claim for that or not.
Why should that not have been excluded from the charge when there's no recovery?
Well, we firmly believe that there was a recovery at the time. The existing law in the Second District was that the Wrongful Death Act, to the extent it differentiated between parents of stillborn children and live-born children, was unconstitutional. So we had a viable cause of action under the existing law. Now, what happened was, after trial, but before a final judgment was entered, this court reversed the Reese case that we were relying on out of the Fort Worth Court of Appeals, and that's what led to the court modifying its judgment to remove that. The other flaw, with all due respect, I think, in that argument is that this jury, that four deaths, I understand, that four deaths weren't enough, that the jury was somehow incensed with the fact that the unborn children, that's what really pushed them over the edge. That there were four deaths in this accident, and I have a hard time believing that the jury was so that wasn't enough, that they were so inflamed by the unborn children that it led to an improper verdict.
Counsel, would you address the differences between the two positions on the eyewitnesses and their credibility and that aspect of the case? It's a pretty significant part of both briefs.
Sure. It is undisputed that not a single witness, and I hate to even call them eyewitnesses, they were people who happened to be in the vicinity. The closest one was two football fields behind the rock truck. But not a single witness saw either vehicle outside of its own lane. But we know that didn't happen. What Wilton said six times in his deposition, and he repeated at trial, Mr. Lawrence, the driver of the Ford truck, what he said was he never saw the rock truck until he heard the noise from the collision and he looked down the road. Now, as counsel has pointed out, when asked, well, if he had been just driving in the other lane, wouldn't you have noticed that? Sure, he would have noticed that. Our position wasn't that he spent miles of his time driving in the other lane. Our position was that for at least the 3 or 4 seconds that it took for Mr. Rodriguez to drive around Cody Jobe, who was turning, the car in front of him had slowed down, pulled over to the shoulder, and was making a right-hand turn. For the 3 or 4 seconds it took this untrained driver to go around Cody Jobe to get 4 to 6 feet over the center line, that was when he was on the wrong side of the road.
On page one of your brief, you say, for reasons known only to the driver, and the sentence goes on. Anyway, it concludes, Rodriguez was driving in the wrong lane.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a cite to four references in the record, and two or three of them are experts. Dr. Marshak, Marshall was an expert, right?
Marshak.
Yes, and Marshall, Kurt Marshall.
No, Kurt Marshak was, there wasn't a separate Marshall.
Okay. And Lee Jackson.
Lee Jackson.
And then Mr. Melendez, the owner of the truck.
Yes.
Right? Who based it on the driver's recollection that it was 2 or 3 seconds that he was moving to the right. So where did that put him when he started off? Is that the evidence on where he was right before the accident?
Yeah, and I always hate to rely on my own experts, so let me talk about some of the independent pieces of information.
It's a big record, and I just want to be sure that
it is a big.
Those are the references there that we need to look at.
Yeah, it is a big record. The
your answer is that's where we need to look, and that's all you're aware of in the record.
What I'm aware of in the record is that Mr. Rodriguez said he turned 2 or 3 seconds, and he changed it at 1 second. We know that the gouge mark that Jackson, Trooper Rainey, and Dr. Marshak all said the gouge mark was the point of impact. It was 6 inches to 1 foot inside the lane. We know that even TXI's own expert, Mr. Painter, said that a 1.4-second turn would move him laterally to the right approximately 7 feet. And then we have the testimony from Mr. Wilton, the passenger in the Ford truck, who what he did testify to was that when he heard the noise and he looked down the road, he saw the Yukon come off of the back. He saw the rock truck curving to the right. He saw the Yukon come off of the rock truck, and the Yukon was in its own lane. So
when it came off the truck.
When it came off the back of the truck, it was in its own lane.
That was in its own lane when it hit the truck.
No, but I think it means that the rock truck, it is at least consistent with our theory that the back of the rock truck was in her lane.
But how can that be if the gouge mark was on the other lane?
Because you have to take into account the sheer length of this. The gouge marker was at the second axle of the truck, and you can drop back approximately 20 to 25 feet from that to the end of the truck.
You'd concede there's at least some evidence her car was the one that crossed over in front of the truck.
I concede that there is a lot of evidence that at some point she crossed the center line. That's exactly consistent with our theory. The question is why? What prompted it?
Well,
no one disputes that.
The question is, if that's the case, how can we exclude the evidence of three or four cell phone calls made at precisely the moment of the accident? That just seems completely unfair to let you mention, or whoever the trial counsel was, 40 times we're suing this illegal immigrant. But the fact that she received cell phone calls undisputed at the time of the accident, and the trial judge excludes that.
And I'll address the cell phone.
Right. What was he thinking?
And let me say, just because when you said unfair, it triggered a thought that I know they have painted this as unfair. I want to. 3 years and 3 months prior to this, Mr. Rodriguez, and it's in the record, it wasn't allowed to go to jury, he was driving a rock truck, took a turn too sharp, flipped the rock truck. The trial court excluded that evidence because he found it would be too prejudicial to the defense. The trial court also allowed in the clearance poll, which had disappeared.
We're going to try to get in that the driver who we blame for this had an accident 3 years before that and therefore must have been negligent on this occasion?
When it goes to his experience, and yes, the whole point of the negligent hiring claim is they have to examine the safe driving record. Does he have a safe driving record?
So if you have an accident, that's coming in every future accident as evidence that you were negligent forever.
Unfortunately, if you're a commercial driver under the Federal Motor Carrier Act.
Skip over that ruling.
The cell phone evidence, there was one call that was excluded, the 155 call. That was at the time of the accident. That's what they say. There was absolutely no evidence that it was answered. Kim Hughes, who was driving the car, had not used that phone the entire morning. That's undisputed in the offer of proof. The prior 2 hours, there had been three calls that cell phone had been used for. All of them were used by her daughter in the back seat. An hour and a half before the accident, from that point until the accident, the cell phone was not used at all. The calls to the cell phone.
Appeals opinion, it says that there was evidence that offered proof outside the jury's presence that he made a call lasting 2 minutes at 1:55, and another one at 1:57, and another one at one incoming call on her phone at 1:55, and the driver's 911 call is 1:56.
Correct. So it's the 1:55 call that is their issue that they've raised. And the point I'm making is there has to be some causal connection, something to link it. For example, they cite the Hiscott case. The Hiscott, there was not only billing records, there was eyewitness testimony that the driver had only one hand on the wheel, was distracted by the phone. Here, there was no corroborating evidence that the phone rang, that she heard it. Again, from 12:21 until the time of the accident, no one answered that phone. There were three calls. Clint was trying to call his wife. Afton in the back of the Yukon.
Great case and great argument. You might have won with the jury on that, but shouldn't the jury been allowed to decide that? I agree. If somebody's sitting on the side of the road in a parked car and gets hit, and you want to introduce evidence that they were drunk, we don't let you do that because they weren't moving. It could not have possibly contributed to anything. But when there's some evidence, which you concede there was, that maybe she crossed over the yellow line, why doesn't that create some tie together to explain to the jury why that might have happened?
Where I disagree is that it was not evidence. There was, on the billing records, a two-minute call. There was no other proof that it was ever answered. And I agree with you that it would also go to the weight. But there's a point where if the evidence has no weight.
2 minutes.
I'm sorry?
Phones don't ring and ring and ring and ring for 120 seconds.
Sure they do. In fact, Clint Royce's call at 128, which everyone agreed was never answered, that was why he called his brother-in-law at 129, that was listed as a two-minute call. No one ever answered.
Which he was more distracting, talking on the cell phone or diving for your pocket or purse to find where your cell phone that's ringing is?
I don't believe there's evidence of either here.
Counsel, let me ask one question. I was thinking in the brief somewhere that someone said that the lady who went to the wreck and rescued the baby heard someone speaking on the cell phone So it would seem as though the call had been answered somehow. Am I misremembering the briefing on that?
You're not, Judge Johnson. It's two separate phones. The phone that she heard was Shiloh, the son, who was sitting in the front passenger seat. It was his phone. And also one other thing, I know my time is up on that, but if the point here was to find out whether this entire trial turned on the admission of that cell phone evidence, I would note that the jury knew that cell phones were being used in the car. They heard from Ms. Windham, as Justice Johnson just pointed out. She went up, she told the jury that the car was absolutely silent and still, except for the voices she heard on the cell phone and the baby screaming. They knew cell phones were in use in the car. They factored that into the decision. It goes along with their theory of throw everything on the wall and see what sticks. Apparently, there was a tire blowout at the exact same time she was reaching for a phone while she was eating fast food. The jury heard all of this. They knew all of that, and they came to the decision anyway.
Your time has expired. Chief, may I ask one question?
Sure.
There's a 1961 case, I think it came out of Beaumont, Benate versus Berry, and essentially says reference to the immigration status of an illegal alien was so long ago held to be so prejudicial on its face that this harm is incurable. Now, my understanding of this record here is that the judge admonished the jury to not let bias, sympathy, and prejudice like they normally would in the charge, but also specifically references illegal alien status to not let that influence the jury's decision. Do you think that instruction is enough to cure whatever prejudicial effect that connotation may have?
I think it was. And in context, this was not brought up in voir dire. It was not brought up in opening. It was not brought up in closing by us. They brought it up in closing. You have that coupled with the instruction. I absolutely think that was enough.
Any further questions? Thank you, Counselor.
Please, the court. Yes, the submission of the unborn twins was prejudicial. And the Court of Appeals says, oh, well, the prejudice is taken care of because we got rid of the $400,000 award. Well, there's something about submitting a claim and presenting evidence of damages that goes beyond just that particular claim. It's part of the overall unfairness at every level. They get a inferential rebuttal. We don't get an inferential rebuttal. They get stuff in that has no connection with the accident. We can't even get cell phone evidence in. Mr. Stagner said, we had no choice but to cross-examine Ricardo Rodriguez as the first witness in this case. They played his deposition. This is not a situation like you mentioned, Justice Brister, in Reliance Steel. If somebody gets up and says, I'm a mom-and-pop shop, then, yeah, you can say you're misleading things, and you can cross-examine on that. In the direct examination, Ricardo Rodriguez did not take the stand and say, I'm an American citizen. And then they cross-examined him. They put it in as a first witness. They played the deposition. They played that testimony. And to say they had no choice then to cross-examine, they created the cross-examination. They injected it from the beginning of this case, and they were allowed to do that time and time again. And they were allowed to do that because the jury questions weren't formed right, because the jury didn't get any kind of guidance on how to decide this case, and was allowed to do anything they wanted to do in this case. And to say that they had no choice when they're injecting the issue is ridiculous. Mr. Jackson didn't testify that the drop truck was on the wrong side of the road. I don't know why that keeps coming up in this case. You look at Volume 9, pages 110 through 120. He clearly says, no, there's no evidence whatsoever that the drop truck was ever in the wrong lane. I thought the clearance pole was the first impact. I didn't think that the gouge mark was the first impact. I thought the gouge mark was the impact in the fourth wheel. Page 14 of the DPS record says the first impact was the clearance pole. They get a little cute with the question, the impact, and they want to say the impact means the initial impact, and then they try to say that Jackson agreed that was the initial impact. He didn't. In fact, in their brief, they say Jackson agreed that was the initial impact, and then they say on page 38 of their brief, let's look at the evidence that it wasn't the initial impact, and they cite Jackson.
We give the trial judge great discretion as the gatekeeper of the evidence.
That's correct.
That's a very, very good rule. And in this instance, the trial judge, for whatever reason, decided to exclude the opinion testimony of the DPS trooper as being cumulative. Is that in itself reversible error?
The testimony of an independent witness is not cumulative. She had experience, training, advanced training. She was supervised by a sergeant with 26 years in the DPS force. There were five DPS officers investigating a multiple fatality accident, something they do not do casually. And we couldn't even put in the evidence that they thought the driver took corrective measures, that they saw no evidence that the Glock truck had gone on the wrong side of the road. And that is fundamentally unfair.
Do you have to have special qualification to testify to that? Because my understanding is she only went to two of the six training classes that were required to become a so-called expert in that area? Or is it the fact that her experience, as you just stated, sufficient enough for the trial judge to have allowed that testimony?
Well, in the Lingenfelter versus Shute case, it held that level two training is sufficient. We also have in this case that she was supervised by a 26-year veteran, Sergeant Rial. We also have that other officers were involved. This was no small accident that was investigated. And to say that it's cumulative, when they moved for mistrial, when Officer Rial was on the stand because they thought we were trying to put the accident report to the judge who kept out before the jury, they moved for mistrial because they didn't want that accident report to get in. And then to say that that is cumulative is absolutely ridiculous. Okay. At every level.
In the prior cases you've cited where we've excluded expert testimony, a number of them, maybe most of them, involve an absence of facts to support the expert's opinions, or the conclusions from the facts that the expert looked at are just have an illogical leap and there's not the connection, so-called analytic gap. Here, Marshak, unlike Volkswagen versus Ramirez, for example, made personal observations, had in-person measurements, conducted some physical tests, and reaching his conclusion that the rock truck crossed the center line. And Volkswagen, the expert, didn't do any of that, didn't do any testing. Are you just disagreeing with the expert's interpretation of the facts, or is there really some relevant and reliability question here that should lead us to exclude the expert?
What we're saying is he made two assumptions that have no basis in fact and no basis in scientific methodologies or scientific training, that the angle of the gouge mark of the Yukon's wheel, after it already had some collision, without knowing any steering input from the driver of the Yukon, which could have turned the wheel, that shows the angle of the rock truck at the time of the first impact at the second axle. That is essential to his opinions. He chooses the second axle because it fits with his view. When the major damage was done at the fourth axle, and he has absolutely no reason, as Justice Gardner said, to pick the second axle other than the fourth axle where most of the damage was, other than it doesn't fit my theory. As Mr. Hurd said in cross-examining, I know you don't think that it hit the fourth axle, but why do you not think that it hit the fourth axle and caused the gouge mark when that was the point of the biggest impact? How could it not have made a mark? Well, it made a mark maybe, but not a very big mark.
The second point?
Because those are assumptions that don't have a basis in fact, that are simply speculative testimony, because there's no scientific methodology that says I can look in my accident reconstruction book and whenever I see a wheel turn this way, that's going to tell me the direction of the other car. There's nothing like that. So there's no scientific methodology, and he's basing it on assumptions that don't hold up.
Any further questions? Thank you, counsel. That cause is submitted, and the court will take another brief recess.
All rise.